Mr. Brown?
I'm just joking.
I'll keep an eye. I'll give you five.
Are you recording this too?
Okay.
So, yeah, I might be faster than the half hour, so. But we still kind of.
That's permitted.
We'll still.
Yep, we'll round by the half hour.
All right.
Does the Zoom end?
Unless the recording has to be done through Zoom.
The recording's on. But
okay.
Does the Zoom need to be on?
No.
No, the meeting is technically over, so okay. I don't think it needs
they to can send their PowerPoint separately. If...
Is there anybody on the Zoom?
There's one person.
There's one person that I don't know why they're...
You know...
Oh, we could leave it on.
If somebody is willing to listen...
That's true.
...and get trained, I would...
They're a future council member.
Be my replacement.
Commission member.
Yeah.
You can keep the Zoom open because...
Okay.
Right.
We'll leave it on.
Thank
it's
you.
It's good for everybody to understand, hopefully.
Wait, oh, never mind. I just say we're close to meeting. We don't even know who it is for the record, so never mind.
Let's go.
Okay. All right. I'm going to be talking about accessory dwelling units. And in my slide, it's internal accessory dwelling units or detached accessory dwelling units, otherwise known as, in our ordinance, as guest houses. And the main thing to consider between the two is you're only allowed one ADU per qualifying property. So if you can't have an internal and a detached and a guest house, so you have to make up your mind on those if you want to have one.
But just to clarify, you only have to apply for a detached. You don't have to apply formally for an internal, correct?
Yes, you do.
Oh, you do. Okay.
I'll go into that. An internal. This is the Utah State Code describes an internal dwelling unit, an IADU, as an internal accessory dwelling unit. It's an accessory dwelling unit created within the footprint of the primary dwelling for the purpose of offering long-term rental of 30 consecutive days or longer. Maybe I'm not going to get this to move.
Hey, Greg, while you're working on that, when it says property, that word, like sometimes I'm trying to sort that out in my mind, lot, parcel, property. Can you help me understand what that constraint is? Is it per address, per lot? I guess
it would be a per lot or a parcel that has a primary dwelling on it. In this case, I mean, you can have a vacant lot with an ADU. So,
do all of our for residential purposes, is that one to one for lot and parcel?
The only lots in a residential zone would be that could have more than one would be in a multifamily residential zone, which we do not allow them in the multifamily residential zones. So.
Okay. Thank you.
I just don't know what button I pushed here, but it's not changing.
And while you're just advancing, sorry, you said something like a vacant lot could have an ADU. But
no,
how do you determine that?
No, a vacant lot cannot.
Oh, cannot. Okay, sorry. I thought you said can. Okay, sorry. I opened a question.
No. Try hitting the escape or.
I'll try. There we go. Okay. And IADU is a permitted use in any area zoned primarily for residential use. And there's a way out of that because multifamily residential is primarily residential. However, it does allow in the state code, which I'm not going to go in too deeply on that, but if a certain percentage of, if the amount of area that is zoned multifamily residential is less than, I think it's less than 20% of the all the other residential zones, which in this case we have very little, it's not allowed in that, you can prohibit it in that zone. Any zone that's residential that doesn't have at least 25% of that area is the, it can be, the city can prohibit it in that zone.
I don't think I followed that, I'm so sorry.
Well, Each of our zones, the multifamily one, the R18, the R25, all take up a certain amount of area.
Mm-hmm.
So We take 100% of the residentially zoned areas, the zone area that they all cover. If there's one of them in there that or more that don't have 25% of it, the city can prohibit.
Okay.
Prohibit the IADUs.
Do we?
And we do in the multifamily residential okay. zone.
Thank you.
All the other ones, there's others that aren't, but we don't prohibit them in the single family residential zones. We just do prohibited in the multifamily. So a municipality may not establish any restrictions or requirements for the construction or use of one IADU within a primary dwelling regarding the size of the internal IADU in relation to the primary dwelling. Total lot size, but I wrote an exception on here because there is an exception to that. And we'll get to the exceptions that are coming up. And street frontage. You don't have to have a certain amount of street frontage.
So a flag lot could qualify?
Right.
Okay.
move on to the next page. However, these are the exceptions. A municipality may, one, prohibit the installation of a separate utility meter for an internal accessory dwelling unit. So those are the things we can do. And we do that. The city follows that most of all of these. We may require that an internal accessory dwelling unit be designed in a manner that does not change the appearance of the primary dwelling as a single family dwelling. And we do that by not allowing them to put entrances and so forth in front of the house. They don't get any extra mailboxes put out in front. So it still looks like from the street, it's a single family house. We can require the owner of a primary dwelling to obtain a permit or license for renting an ADU. The city requires a permit through the online portal. And with that, we don't require a license, but we do require them to, with that permit, they have to provide an affidavit stating the owner will comply with all regulations regarding IADUs. And it has to be, it's an affidavit that says that, it's notarized and it's recorded with Salt Lake County. So we require that. We also require, the state allows us to require a primary dwelling, regardless of whether the primary dwelling is existing or new construction, to include one additional on-site parking space for an internal, for an IADU, in addition to the parking spaces required under our code. So we require two covered parking spaces for each new home. And so if they're going to have an ADU, an IADU, if they're building that, it's because we do have some now that are building their IADUs right off the bat with, finishing their basements as such.
Not required to be covered though, right?
No, it just has to be on the property. And in our code, we restrict it from, we don't allow it to inhibit the use of the existing, of the other spaces. So you can't have a two-car garage and then a two-car wide driveway and have an ADU parking in the driveway if it's blocking the garage. In other words, it's got to make it, that would be inhibiting the other parking spaces. And you also can't say, oh, it's in the garage and I'm going to park my other car outside. No, that doesn't work either. So you can do that, but you got to park it where the ADU is supposed to be. So we can prohibit the creation of an internal accessory dwelling unit if the lot containing the primary dwelling is 6,000 square feet or less in size. And that goes back to that exception that I noted before. And that's in state code exactly that way. And we also have that in our code as well. We are allowed to prohibit the rental or offering of rental an internal accessory dwelling unit for a period of less than 30 consecutive days. So we don't allow them to rent it. It's a short-term rental if it's 30 days or less, or less than 30 days. And so they have to rent it for at least 30 consecutive days or longer to be more of a long-term rental. We also prohibit the rental of an internal accessory dwelling unit if the internal accessory dwelling unit is located in a dwelling that is not occupied as the owner's primary residence. And that's why we have that affidavit saying that they're going to follow all the rules, and that's one of them they have to follow. It is probably difficult to find out, you know, that later if they've, you know, have renting both, but somehow we can find out usually from neighbors that let us know. But then it's really hard to prove it, I guess, sometimes. But we can also look at the county records sometimes. If they don't live there, where do they get their tax, their property tax sent to them? And then that gives it away often as well.
Is on rentals, is the whole primary dwelling and the ADU the only rental mechanisms for in the residential zone?
You have to have the primary dwelling, and the owner has to live in it, and then right. and then in order to have an internal.
Well, you can rent the ADU, or the owner could rent.
Entire.
Yeah, they have to live in.
They can rent the entire
property.
They can rent the entire dwell property. Yeah, the entire to
property.
One family, I guess that would be fine, but they can't have two units. They can't have an ADU in the basement. And
does the code also prohibit a subletter or a renter from subletting? So the owner of the property can't rent to two different entities. But do we specifically call out that the renter of a full property can't then sublet a portion?
Right. I mean, we can't. Sometimes I'm going to imagine. Sometimes they, if you're renting the whole property, and there's not an ADU in it, sometimes they would rent rooms out or something like that. But we may or may not ever figure out. That's usually not allowed either, unless it's four, or it's again a definition of a family. If there's four more than four unrelated people, it's not a family any longer. But you could have four individual people renting out the same house and living in it together. So, and then but as a family also is identified as anybody related to by blood and all sorts of things, blood, foster children, all those that's all considered as a family. But the definition of family is pretty much universal everywhere. It's more than four unrelated people. So if you have one person in there, well, if you have a family of three people, mom, dad, and a child, they can rent out a room or something to one other person, because now there's still only four unrelated. But if they can't rent it out to two, because now there's five people and they're not all related to each other. So
that seems like a hole. Mm-hmm. Just seems like a hole in the code.
No, it's almost every city has the same definition of a family.
No, you're telling me though you can't rent to multiple people, but effectively if there's an ADU in a home.
Well, if there's an ADU in a home, that's a different story, because they would have you can rent to the person, people in the ADU, and usually it's, I don't know how you prohibit upstairs. It's two families, and it's the same thing with the ADU. They have to meet the family thing too. They can't have more than four unrelated people living in the ADU as well. So.
Okay, I have a question. Okay, so you're only allowed one internal ADU that you're renting out. What happens if there is a second ADU, internal ADU, in the home, but an adult child is living in it and they're claiming it's not an ADU? So they now have two ADUs in one house plus the primary residence that the owners are occupying.
I don't know how that would work in legally, because you're right. If they have three kitchens and three bathrooms, all, you know, and it's whether it's divided off or not, that means, or all they need is three kitchens and one bathroom, because if they're not divided off, that's then we have three ADUs. But I don't know how to would regulate that at all.
Would the city regulate that?
I don't know if we'd
would that have to go through?
If I could comment on that, it's difficult to regulate, but here's some ways that I know the city tries. First of all, if you come in for a permit to have an IADU, you have to sign a pretty detailed affidavit. And one of the items that you're going to have to swear to is that you're only going to have one IADU, and then you're going to also have to swear that the rest of the building or rest of the structure will be owner occupied. And you have to say that it's okay to have this inspected on a periodic basis by the city. And I'm trying to remember anything else, but those affidavits have to come in, and the city can do and does do from time to time inspections to see that these things are being done. But it's a difficult thing, and I'm sure there are people all over the city getting away with things.
Just to follow up on all those inspections. So first, recognize Commissioner Bishop has joined us here in the press. So make sure he gets credit for this evening. That's what's key on the record. But on those inspections, are the residents given notice saying, you know, we're going to show up in 2 weeks or 2 days? So maybe making it difficult as well, because they could clear out basically any potential violations? Or
the one that we had most recently, it was something staff found through a building permit. They were requesting a building permit and for a detached ADU, and we understood that the house already had one in the basement, and we denied the permit for the detached one. And then of course the owner came in to argue about that, and we said, well, we can come out this afternoon and take a look. If you let you, we'll have to look and make look inside your basement. And he said, well, you can't just come out and do that. And yes, we can, because you have an ADU. If you don't have an ADU, then fine. Then, but if you have an ADU, we have to inspect the ADU that we assume that's in there. And he said, okay, fine. And he went, and yes, he did have an ADU. So we told him, you're going to have to do something else.
Back up. What makes an ADU? I know we don't have to have internal walls anymore.
It's just,
or separate exits.
You have a kitchen and a bathroom
together. So if you have two kitchens and two bathrooms in your home, you automatically...
It's an ADU.
Okay. I thought at one point we talked about this, and you said that you can't prevent somebody from having 10 kitchens if that's what they would like in their house. Just like
can't.
I have four bathrooms.
Let's see, I guess it's not going to come to anybody's attention unless they start renting out to multiple people.
Okay.
And actually, if somebody has an ADU in their basement and then they have adult children that can occupy another part of the basement, the adult children are family, so they don't count as necessarily as renters of the ADU. I think we would probably still, I don't know what we do, because an ADU is it's when you have
kitchen and a bathroom.
Okay. And doesn't even say bedrooms anymore. It says kitchen and a bathroom. So it could be we have several pool houses that have kitchens and bathrooms in them, and then they have just like a, let's call it a rec room or whatever it is.
Sure.
And we've had to have them apply for a guest house.
Interesting. And I would argue a lot of people's basements probably, without intending to, meet the definition
mm-hmm.
of an IADU, just because they want their movie theater room with a
kitchen. And those, you know, are never going to get found out, probably, because they were probably built before we had, you know, if I get a building permit on that, then we see it, then we notice it's an ADU. And,
okay.
And in that case, we do have a way around it. The state allows us to have them, or actually requires us, we can't just accuse them of renting it out. We have to ask them, what is your intention? And they say it's intended for family use only, then we have to believe them.
Okay.
And so then they can't, then hopefully they're not renting it out.
Is the city still requiring on that building permit process, if they say it's for family use only, is the city still requiring like an internal kitchen covenant, a second kitchen covenant, or whatever it's called here? Cities require you to the same process as you do in an ADU, that you fill out a form and you record it with the county that this is not going to be rented out. Does
no,
South Jordan require anything like that?
I haven't
okay.
seen that happening. So. But we do have it on record when they say, you know, because we send them, we put it in there electronically, mm-hmm. and what are your intentions with this finished basement that you've got? And they say for family use only, and then we stamp it on the, we make that into a stamp and put it on the plans, and it's kept forever. So if it ever becomes an ADU, we'll say you know.
And at that point, they would just need to apply for an ADU permit, right?
Then they can apply for one, because they'll get one, because they are permitted, and so they'll have one. It'll just cost them the extra, you know, it's $140 for the ADU permit that staff reviews anyway. When it comes to Planning Commission, it's quite a bit more, so.
So when would someone come to city to apply for an IADU? What drives them to do that?
Because they want to rent out part of their home.
Okay, but it has to be rented.
Well, that's what usually that drives them to do, is they want to make, you know, if they, or, you know, if they already have the kitchen, they put it in, you know, 10 years ago when we didn't even know what ADUs necessarily were, and we allowed people to do that. We would and then now they want to rent it. They can come in and apply for the ADU. But if they, another thing is if they don't have an ADU in their house and they need extra income, they find this is a way. Our children have moved away now, so let's rent it out so we can, you know. That's usually what happens, and right now we get a lot of internal ADU applications with new homes. That helps them. And the home buyers in Daybreak complain quite a bit because they're not allowed in Daybreak. And they're probably more expensive in Daybreak too, so it's hard for them to, they're complaining about how hard it is to buy a home in Daybreak. Well, nothing we can do about it at this point, so.
Thank you.
Guest houses. Just go through a few of those. For standards for a guest house, the owner of the property must reside on the property in either the primary dwelling or the guest house. So it doesn't have, they can live in either one. Guest houses are allowed only in the following predominantly residential zones: the A5, A1, R1A, R25, R3, R4, and R5. Approved guest house shall meet the requirements of the underlying zone. And that kind of means, you know, all the setbacks and things that are required. At size, height, area. Because it's not just the guest houses don't just fall under the accessory dwelling in a section of the code. They also go under the detached accessory structure. They have to meet those requirements as well. A guest house shall only be approved on a lot that is equal to or greater than 14,520 square feet. That's a third of an acre. At least one off-street parking space in addition to those that are required for the primary dwelling shall be provided and shall not render the required spaces for the primary dwelling inaccessible. So thing that we talked about before, the IADs, you have to be able to access the garages, and if they've got one. Guest house shall comply with the required setbacks of the underlying zone and accessory building. However, in no case shall a guest house be located closer than 10 feet from the side or rear yard. So they do have to be 10 feet away, you know, even if they're under the 16-foot requirement. Guest houses should be designed and constructed to be compatible with the exterior of the primary dwelling. Example with, you know, exterior materials, colors, roof pitch. Those kind of things should have, there should be some kind of a connection to the primary dwelling. No guest house shall have more than 3 bedrooms. The floor area, as you found out last week, can't exceed 35% of the living area of the primary dwelling or be greater than 1,500 square feet, whichever is less, unless, in the opinion of the Planning Commission, a greater amount of floor area is warranted. So that part is not a conditional use permit before you. It's basically says if you have, if the commission's opinion feels that it's warranted, then you can allow it.
What does that mean to be, to feel like it's warranted?
Whatever, if you think it's okay, then, or you know it's warranted, that they should be allowed a bigger guest house because their primary dwelling is monstrous and they have enough room to put it on there without it looking out of place. I suppose that could be considered warranted. I don't know.
Is the warranted more like the compatibility in the, you know, our opinion of its compatibility versus, because otherwise it feels weird to try to say, like, I don't think the reason you want that is a good reason.
Warranted can almost sound like, oh, you know, these people have, they want to rent to somebody that has 6 kids and they need a bigger one with more bedrooms and a bigger space. I don't think that's the case. It says opinion of the Planning Commission. I guess whatever opinion you may have is can go. I don't know. What do you think, Greg? So.
Well, I think if you want to exceed these standards, they're going to be in there on a conditional use permit. And I'm going to go over conditional use permits in some detail here in a few minutes, and we'll talk about this issue of whether it's warranted. I'm not sure that's the standard you need to apply. We'll talk about it.
I read something similar to that, or into that. That word came up when Greg, you used that again. I was like, what does that mean?
That's the way it's written in the code. It says, and it stops right there. But,
okay.
I don't think I have anything else other than the parking is the same. The rental still 30 days or more. No short-term rentals are allowed in the detached ADUs either.
Like on a detached ADU and maybe an internal ADU, is there any restrictions on families? So, like, let's just stay with an external ADU. If there's 4 or more unrelated people living in a ADU, is that allowed?
If it's more than 4, it's not allowed.
More than 4. Is that inclusive of all ADUs and the primary property? I'm just trying to figure out how to.
Yeah, it's a single family dwelling is considered for one family, and if it's being rented or it's own, it can't. It's, if a single person buys it, and they can also get roommates, 3 more roommates, and it's fine. But they can't have 4 roommates. And the same thing with renting the ADU, a guest house. One person could be on the lease, but he could have. He or she could have three others living in the same okay. ADU, but granted, it's only a 3-bedroom ADU, and they might, I don't know.
So that's inclusive of all the dwelling areas on that property.
So
a total of no more than 4 unrelated people.
Right.
And I guess the term unrelated, if someone marries into the family, so this is an example,
they're related.
They are considered related by the law. Okay, just making sure as I'm might be in this circumstance in the not so distant future.
We're coming for you.
Well, or daughter-in-law, son-in-law. They're not, you know, blood relation.
Aunts and uncles, cousins.
Okay.
In, you know, people that have, by marriage, it's listed as fine foster children. They're related as well. So.
Okay. So this is, and this is like kind of one of those things that helps, I think, in the future, like thinking about this, making it more dense, it doesn't necessarily make it, it doesn't allow that much more density because it's being constrained by the family rule, right? I mean, in theory, right? Like how many people are gonna, I don't know, anyway.
Well, they follow the law.
I guess what I'm saying is like, sometimes I think about these external dwelling units especially, and how big some of them are and how big their other house could be, I think, wow, that's a lot of people that could be on that lot. But it really, as long as they're related,
mostly. Well, yeah, the single family homes can have, if a large family, then that's one thing, but.
Yeah, okay. So. All right, thanks.
I don't have anything else on my just answering questions. So
you're right at the 30-minute mark.
Just one really quick, just because I see it, at least in my area, real quick, because I see they're not external units, but they are trailers, RVs, campers, that people are definitely staying in more than 30 days, and they may or may not be related. How does, I'm assuming that there's no way they could apply for a permit for that, and that's probably definitely not a legal use, and just people have to go, neighbors complain to code enforcement.
Right.
That's the only, and we know it's a known problem with the current housing situation probably, but.
Yeah, that might be the case, but yeah, we don't have any way of finding that out unless they, because we don't require people to let us know that they have parking a trailer.
And if there is, they're living in a trailer now, but then they come in and apply for an external application, they would be found out during that process.
Right, they would be found out then, so, because that's not what it is.
It wouldn't meet the qualifications for a guest house.
Yeah, and then a guest house, you can only have one guest house. I'm just seeing, you know, we approve one, and they're going to come in saying, hey, we still have a large lot, and we can put a second one in.
Yeah. Well, a trailer, like you're saying, though, wouldn't meet our code for,
well, for all
what areas. A guest house has to be.
Yeah, because it didn't meet the material.
Right, right.
Yeah, it doesn't meet the material, it's got wheels and all kinds of things, but and then of course just remember there's only one ADU allowed per property, regardless whether it's inside the primary unit or detached from it. So
perfect.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Simonson, you're up.
I've got his.
Oh, counselor's coming to the bar here.
Yeah. We're going to look each other in the eye.
He's like, this time it's going to get through. I know it. He's looking right at the three of us.
This is our annual CEP training. It hasn't sunk in after 5 years. I don't know if it will at this point.
It's our favorite. It will. Six times a charm, whatever we're on.
So, I have a slide thing too, but I also made you a copy.
Oh, thank you.
Okay.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
Deception and discretion. Oh, and there's no disclaimers on the cover page either.
Okay, so on this cover sheet, you'll see that I've put the words, the deception of discretion, that, and I'm going to explain a little bit what that means. What do you think the average person that's coming in here to comment on a conditional use permit, what do you think they think the situation is?
But if they object, it's done.
Yeah.
They have to justify their need for the, like, their use. Like, they have to prove that they deserve it.
They think that this is a democracy, which you're really not. You are not a democracy. You're a planning body. You've not been elected, and that's by purpose. So that you can concentrate on planning. What is the best plan? What does the evidence show? What is the best planning situation for the future of South Jordan? And the code is designed for that specifically, so that you're insulated. You don't have to worry about getting reelected. I don't know why anybody in here would want to be reelected, for that matter. but you're performing a very important service, often thankless. Okay, so the next slide. How do I do this? Yeah, I'm pushing them left and right.
All hands on deck, here we go.
Oh, I have to turn it on.
Yeah.
Oh.
Hey, it's
okay, so there we go. All right, thank you, Matt. Okay, so the deceptive nature of the term conditional use permit. I remember one time a citizen writing and saying, and asking a question, could you please tell me the conditions that the permit applicant is trying to meet in order to receive their permit? That's just the opposite of what is happening here. The applicant is not here to try and prove that they deserve the permit. The look at number two, the correct assumption is that the use should be allowed since the ordinance would not provide for the use if the use were not deemed desirable in the first place. So that's where you begin.
So this is just a review to make sure certain uses aren't having an undesirable impact, but by default should be allowed unless somebody brings forward
evidence.
A very faithful convincing argument. Evidence that, okay.
That's right, and we'll get into that in more detail, but you've correctly stated it. So number three, the decision whether the use is appropriate in the zoned area has already been made by the city council. And all we're reviewing is if this particular application has some quantified detriment, supported by evidence, detrimental effect that may require or suggest that we impose some conditions to mitigate those detrimental effects. Okay. So real quickly, because I think you guys are pretty experienced on this stuff, let's take a look at the actual code on the next slide. The Planning Commission, this is the city code, shall approve a conditional use permit application if reasonable conditions are proposed or can be imposed to mitigate the reasonably anticipated detrimental effects of the proposed conditional use in accordance with the applicable standards. B, the Planning Commission may deny a conditional use permit application if the reasonably anticipated detrimental effects of a proposed conditional use cannot be substantially mitigated by the proposal or imposition of reasonable conditions to achieve compliance with applicable standards. That's the code that we have here in the city. Then the next slide is the state code, which our code is patterned after, and it's pretty much the same standard. But if you'll look at the second item here on the slide, there's some clarification that's different from our code. It says the requirement to mitigate the detrimental effects does not require elimination of the detrimental effects. Okay, and I don't know this, but I suspect that some planning commission somewhere denied a conditional use permit, and they said because the detrimental effects had not been eliminated, and the development community came in, probably came in and got that additional language added on there. So this is where I really want to be, this next slide, and we want to, the next three slides focus on a case that I don't think we've discussed in great detail before in our training, and that is this Davis County versus Clearfield. Why is Davis County suing Clearfield in this situation? And the decision that comes out of this, this is back in 1988, but it's still a premier, often cited, quoted, relied upon case in any conditional use permit denial or appeal that goes before a court. And I want you to know that what I'm thinking when you're considering conditional use permits, this is what I'm sitting over there thinking. I'm thinking, okay, I can see that they're thinking of denying this conditional use permit. How am I going to defend it if this gets appealed? And I'm sitting there crossing my fingers saying, okay, whoever's making the motion or explaining their decision, they're going to say something like this. They're going to say, I'm going to vote for denying this conditional use permit. And the reason I'm going to vote against it is because I place great weight on the testimony of so-and-so who came up here and presented these studies and then so-and-so also did this, and here's the evidence before me, and I find this persuasive, okay? And then you've gone on the record and you've pointed to the specific evidence that you're relying upon. Now, that doesn't guarantee you'll win an appeal, but it's going to make it possible. If you don't do that, then you're going to get into a situation that we're going to talk about here in this Davis County versus Clearfield case. Okay, so Davis County proposed using a remodeled home as a center for the treatment of those suffering from substance abuse and applied for a conditional use permit. Now, their application for a conditional use permit is an indication that there's already an ordinance on the books allowing this use in that area, but for reasons that are not explained in the case, it's a conditional use permit rather than just simply permitted. The proposed home was across the street from a junior high school, and local residents turned out in force and objected strenuously, and the application was denied. And on appeal, the Court of Appeals overturned the decision to deny the CUP because they said it was only supported by public clamor. And let's get into some more specific things in the next slide about what they specifically ruled. First of all, you don't want to be viewed as having made an arbitrary decision. And so the first thing the court says is the denial of a permit is arbitrary when the reasons are without sufficient factual basis. Okay. You've got to have facts. All right. Second, the consent of neighboring landowners may not be made a criterion for the issuance or denial of a conditional use permit. You can get the whole city here. You can have them lined up the stairs outside. You can have them by the thousands on television. And they all think, I'm coming before a body that this is America, and this is a legislative thing, and we're here to give our opinions, and our opinions matter. They don't. That's the deceptive part of planning of conditional use permits. They don't matter. You can get everybody who has an opinion, and usually who you have show up are the people that are living closest, you know. And but it can matter if they're supported by facts, particularly what we call substantial evidence. And I'm going to talk about that more. What is that?
So, Greg, on something like, I'm remembering that you said at some point, we can't also delay the fact-finding process. You have to be careful about that once it comes up. So, for example, if you're looking to find, to understand the evidence of, say, like, how many external buildings do we have in this zone or in this thing, and no one knows the answer to that, is that enough to, you know, and maybe some other things, and if that's important to your fact finding, how do you go about that when we have relatively short turnaround? You know, we get it and we have to like digest it. Sometimes you hear what someone else says and you're like, ooh, I wish I had that knowledge.
Let me ask you this, yeah. Commissioner, with the greatest respect. How in the world is that even relevant? How in the world is it even relevant what others have, how many you've got?
Well, because like when we've, for example, when we entertain the height of these exterior buildings, we often in our conversations have said there are other ones like that, because one of the criteria in the judgment is it will say like, is it fit in the character or whatever, fit in the neighborhood. And so we've had lots of conversations around like, oh, well, other properties have buildings of this size. It's consistent with the area, especially when I'm considering about the external. I'm less concerned whether it's like a school or something else that's going in, because I'm more concerned, especially around those external buildings, which other than lot coverage and some other things, once you exceed those lower boundaries that trigger it coming to us, like, they can be very, very large. Very, very large.
Well, maybe you and I are just going to have a difference of opinion on this. Because in my mind, that doesn't matter. What matters is there a detrimental effect of the application that is before you? And it's not, unless somebody comes in and says, okay, this is going to harm property values. And here's my appraiser, and here's the appraisals that have been done, and here's the study. It's not going to matter. And the fact that the neighbors have beat you to the draw, that they've done it first, maybe you could get a professor from the University of Utah or something to come in and say, this particular application is going to change the nature of this neighborhood completely and destroy these previously sacred rights here. And it's not just because you have the right to have a ADU, it's the right, it's because you're exceeding, I mean, you're exceeding the wall height, or the window's gonna be looking over the neighbor's yard and so forth. Unless you, and let's continue to go through this case.
Talking about it, but I just would love to understand, it's still not clear in my mind, like if there really are generally, because it's hard to find a detrimental effect on an accessory building. You know, really pretty hard, I think. I mean, I haven't found too many, maybe lighting and some other things that you can go off of. But oftentimes, like, there's very little. And so I wonder why the city council sends those if the training or whatever all basically says it should be allowed. With very little constraint, I'm just trying to imagine. Here's where I'm going. Like, in that case, I imagine if every lot did what was allowed, what would happen to the zone, the residential zone? And if that doesn't matter, then I'm okay with that too. It's just whatever we have to do.
I think that determination has basically been made by the city council. They're saying we are going to allow this in every zone. In fact, in the case of some of these uses and IADUs, it's mandated by the legislature. But if the guest house is allowed in the zone, and the zoning ordinance has been enacted by the city council, our legislative body, and they've said you can do this in this zone, but in these cases, well, the walls are too high, or it exceeds the 35% of the primary structure, we're going to give some limited review with a conditional use permit. I personally don't think they ought to do that at all, because I think it puts you in such a tough position. But it's my job to tell you what you can consider and what you can't consider, and that's what I'm trying to do tonight. Okay, so looking at this slide on the holdings of Davis County versus Clearfield, this is what the court specifically said, the third item down. The opposition of neighbors is not one of the considerations to be taken into account when determining whether to issue a development permit. Local government must rely on facts and not mere emotion or local opinion in making such a decision. Now, it's really hard, a lot of times I realize, when you have 40 people come in and all express an opinion that this is a bad thing, to not begin to think this is a bad thing. You know, these seem like pretty sensible people. And earlier tonight, there was a question of whether we leave the microphone on during this training. Well, we've got to get the word out. We need to have people begin to understand what they need to do if they're going to persuade you that a conditional use permit is not wise. Because I sit here just like you and say sometimes, I wish that wasn't going on in our city. I can see that the Planning Commission, given what's presented, had to approve this. But I'd like to see more people educated about what the criterion on. You're getting educated over and over again, and which means that you're going to have a lot of uneducated people come in here and beat you up. And they're going to be
they're going to think, oh, I came here and we expressed our opinion, person after person, and they totally ignored us. Well, let's go on to the next page and talk about specifically something else that the court said. Let's go to the bottom of this next slide. It begins with the opposition. And the opposition did not have factual support in the vague reservations expressed by either the single-family owners or the commission members. The reasons did not justify denial of the permit. And then look at this part I've underlined here. Even though they would have been legally sufficient had the record demonstrated a factual basis for them. And that's the message we need to get across to people that really want to oppose a conditional use permit, is that the reasons may be correct, but if you don't present a factual basis on the record that gives you the tools necessary to consider a denial, you're left without the tools. You just don't have them. And so...
Are we allowed to bring them, or do we have to have it brought to us?
That's a great question, and I'm going to stick my neck out here and say, I think anybody in the city can present factual evidence.
So let's say in this case, I went and found myself a parole officer who could testify that facilities like this have a higher number of police responses, that members of the program often test positive for drugs, et cetera, et cetera. As a member of the commission, can I testify? Can I participate in that and then still vote, or would I have to recuse myself?
Okay, there's two parts to that question. What I'd prefer to see you do is just have the parole officer come and testify. You know, because what you have to say isn't going to add a lot to that.
The parole officer would, though.
Yes. Yes, he comes armed with facts, numbers, experience, actual accounts of similar facilities. So then we're getting into something that the court, if it goes on appeal, the court is going to be much more likely to uphold your denial. Now, as far as whether you have to recuse yourself, ask me when that day comes, because I'll turn around and ask you some questions about the extent of your involvement. If you've been out there not only with the parole officer, but doing all sorts of things and recruiting me to come to the meeting, I may, under those circumstances, suggest that you need to not end up voting, but I don't feel competent to answer that question here and now.
Case by case.
The parole officer could also, instead of coming to the meeting, could submit an email. Is that true?
All the evidence submitted in writing and so forth can logically be considered, and even more important, will become part of the record.
Is there a burden to verify who somebody says they are, certify their credentials?
I don't know that that's addressed anywhere, but I think that it would be very helpful if they did. They stood up and said, I'm Officer so-and-so. This is my experience. Here is my resume. You got one chance to get things in on the record. And so I'd rather see you do too much and get too many things that later maybe you don't use, and then find out, oh, I wish we had done this. I wish we had got this in on there.
So you could ask like what city they're in, or what district, or who's there.
Oh, yeah, certainly.
Sorry, back to your very first question. You phrased the beginning in a way that I wanted to follow up. You indicated not delaying fact finding, but there are times that people will say something, make a claim that I do wish we could say, can we sort that out? Can we get whatever document they're claiming the county has? Can we, there was one time you mentioned that a resident made a comment about the retaining wall or the offset from the road to their property that you said that was probably something you should have followed up on, but they hadn't brought pictures. It was that historic road. Just things like that. At what point can we say, pause, we need to table this to have that evidence brought to us? Or can we not if it hasn't been brought in?
I think that that's within your discretion.
Okay.
So like last meeting when we did late, because it got brought up in testimony, there might have been a utility issue with water. That's something we can table on because that's something that could be a detriment to the to allow for this conditional use. That we, but we would, if they come back, we would then have to try to mitigate that. That's something we could table like we did.
There's a balance to everything. I mean, sure. What I hope I don't see is...
tabling everything.
We need to educate you, audience, on the kind of things that we need to rely on. And here's what we need. And so we're going to now table this so you can go out and get it and come back at the next meeting. I mean, you planning commissioners have the duty to maintain objectivity, and not just objectivity, but also the appearance of objectivity. You need these people when they come and have a decision to feel like you have done the best you can to hear their application and to decide it according to the standards of the law.
So just, I know a lot of times we'll get a lot of public comment and they'll bring things up and we will address every single item they bring up without evidence or, I know it's your next slide, substantial evidence, that just their word for it. Should we, for that level of objectivity, should we be questioning everything that the public clamor is presenting, or should we, if it's not, you know, nitpicking every single item that gets brought up, just what should we be doing as we're these future hearings that we have? Now, if there's something substantial, that might be, obviously, but, you know, just the balance what we have, especially if it gets to a, you know, legal case on appeal.
So let's go back to this top item on the slide that we're on. With regard to concern over real estate values, no studies were made and no opinions were given by professional real estate appraisers, nor was there any credible evidence of reduced property values produced at the hearing. Now you have somebody stand up and say, I'm an expert on property values, and it's my opinion that property values, if you enact this, property values are going to be hurt. Is it possible for you then to ask questions? Okay, you've stated that you're an expert. Please tell us how you became an expert. What's your education? What have you done to evaluate this and reach this conclusion? That's entirely appropriate.
Would we have to amend our rules to do that?
Yeah, I was going to say, how do we do that if it's supposed to be like a one-way conversation?
Mr. Gedge at the end will say I'd like to make a motion to recall so-and-so to establish credentials.
Well, to establish qualifications. Yeah. But yeah, I'm just wondering, because I know staff has put together a staff report. Well, the applicant's made an application, which has been reviewed by staff, and the staff report presented to us, which is what we're supposed to be going off of, unless someone in the audience actually or submits evidence. Should we be going through each little nitpick saying, you know, the lighting's here, is that, or does it get to the level of a detriment that we need to then try to mitigate? You know, I'm just wondering, just so we don't give them the hope, oh, they're thinking about denying this.
I think.
And putting the burden on the applicant also, who's already satisfied everything they're supposed to do.
In discussing with City Council, though, our role, I've received the impression, I personally believe that the role of our hearings are often to allow that avenue of being able to express a frustration, even if we can't do anything about it. But then what I'm getting out of this whole conversation, especially with regards to like accessory dwelling units, is that maybe we need to then provide feedback to city council for, hey, we're getting this feedback. We can't do anything about it, but we think you can with the code or ordinance changes. We probably need to be a little more proactive on what are we hearing.
I think that's an excellent suggestion, because I am here to tell you that the floodgates are opening up on ADUs. You're gonna have this before you repeatedly. I remember back in the days when I was in law school, my dream was to move out to South Jordan. And why? Because they have 1/3 acre lots, they have 1/2 acre lots, and my kids will have a big area to play, and I'll have a little room between me and my neighbors and blah, blah, blah. And now the sentiments and the flow is completely a different way. It's now a lot of these people, and I'm not blaming them, but how can we make money out? What they're almost doing and what's almost being allowed is, we've talked a lot about subdivision. So we're not subdividing the property. You can't sell your guest house apart from your house. But in essence, we're kind of almost subdividing. We're saying we're going to allow 2 residences where we only always allowed 1. And that's a huge change. And so I was really glad for Greg's presentation tonight on what, you know, what the code shows. I learned a lot from that presentation, and
because it can still be 2 buildings, but it still has to be a single family in law.
That's my understanding. Yes, yeah. So, what is evidence that you can, what is substantial evidence? You know, we've talked a little bit about that, studies and so forth, and there's no great answer, but I did find that the term substantial evidence is actually defined in the land use code, and it's on the, I've put it on the last slide, and it's about the least helpful definition I've ever read.
Yeah, I agree.
Concur. Substantial evidence means evidence that is beyond a scintilla. A scintilla, I guess, is really, really tiny. And so I guess what they're saying is, if you're going to deny, if you're going to find a detrimental effect, it probably ought to be a little more than Joey coming up and, you know, that you're just clinging onto one thing against the weight of all the other evidence. The second part is, I think, a little more helpful. A reasonable mind would accept as adequate to support a conclusion. Now, you know, I was joking with Ryan, my boss. So is it true that reasonable minds get more reasonable the higher it's appealed? And so, and so, you know... But this is why the record is so important. Not only the recordings, but, you know, when I was out in private practice representing landowners that were trying to get permits and entitlements and so forth, I would tell them, let's put everything on the record that we possibly can, because you never know what you're going to need. And we would get studies, and we would get other things, and we would you know, we would make the recorder walk out of the room carrying these boxes of things, you know, so that if we needed to go to court, we would have the support and documents that we needed to substantiate what we had said. So that's basically what I've prepared. I hope this was in some small measure helpful. And if you have any questions, ask them now, but you can also email me or call me anytime.
Thank you.
What's the difference between a nuisance and a detrimental effect?
Between what and detrimental?
A nuisance and a detrimental effect. Because I was noticing there was nuisances when we were dealing with the vehicle things, and nuisances is defined in the code.
I don't know.
Okay.
I think that somebody such as yourself will ponder on that.
I will ponder on it. The other thing, I'm wondering, like, CUPs are noticed, right?
Yes.
So
I think that the note, let me, sorry to interrupt, yeah, but okay. I think the notices help convince the public that CUPs are different. I mean, we have to notice them. But when we notice them and say, this item is coming up for a conditional use permit hearing on such and such date, and you're invited to come and comment, we kind of play into this idea that there's more discretion and there's more, you know, allowing of personal opinions and feelings than there really is.
Do we point them to any training or materials, like on a website, like, and I've mentioned this before, but like a QR code that says, like, hey, you've got 2 weeks to put your best thinking as a surrounding neighbor into this conditional use permit to identify it, you know, it's generally allowed, and so you're only looking for effects, and here's examples. Do we have anything like that for a citizen and for an applicant? You know, because the applicant doesn't really have to do anything, right, that much that they haven't already done. But I'm really concerned about the people who, like you said, the training and so forth, the preparation for people coming in here, mostly because I want them to have a good experience coming in and saying, like, that they understand what's allowed, what they're supposed to do as part of the process. So I think sometimes I probably leave this perception that I'm favoring one or the other, but it's really, I just want the best decision to be made, and I'm trying to encourage people, you know, to get prepared, but we can't delay it once it starts just because someone doesn't have facts. So can I draft up something? If I drafted up something, if there isn't one that exists,
on our website, welcome to the Planning Commission.
Or just,
come to a meeting.
Not just say may give comment, maybe give testimony and evidence. I mean, just change a small change in wording. Because, yeah, they can comment, but unless it's something that we can actually consider.
Yeah, I'm just talking about some examples of the common things.
The best thing I think you could do for somebody is remember those Craig Call books that I've given you. Okay, he calls those a citizen's guide to land use. And that's how he's written it, is to try and reach out to citizens. And if you go through there, you read, okay, tips for handling this, what they're going to consider. And he really tries to cover that, not just with conditional use permits, but all sorts of different applications. And those can be bought online. So that's a resource. They're not very expensive. I don't remember what they cost, but they're not very expensive. But I think that's something that a resource. There's no problem with handing this out. It cites the code. If you want to know where to find the code, here it is. There's a line to be drawn. I think that you would perform a service by educating people. I just don't want it to go so far that all of a sudden you're having to recuse yourself.
Yeah. And that's my concern, is our role is not to just defend other people who are against it, the application, but also the staff who's recommending it, and also the applicant. There's two sides, and it seems a lot that we've tried to find ways to deny instead of maybe ways to approve the application that's before us.
To mitigate
yes.
the concerns that people have.
Which is our role per the code. And now through legal opinion since 1988, I think you cited, that you're showing us this evening.
And all I was saying is, like, I definitely will, because of this training, be more careful in a meeting But I definitely feel like there is a void that feels like the city maybe has a responsibility to partially educate the citizens about the process and could do a better job, at least as far as I understand, in preparing that and giving them some resources to understand what how they can make an impact so that the quality of the conversation, the quality of the evidence or statements will be more than just feelings, because we can't do anything about the feelings and the fears.
But right. I don't know if that, I mean, that seems like, here, dear citizens, here's how you can protest an application.
It's not protest. It's like, what are the requirements? So like, it's like saying, here are generally things considered detrimental effects. You know, it could be like you list things and you say, well, lighting is covered in this thing. Like there's light transmit requirements that says, you know, you can't cross a property line or at a certain rate. And all we have to do is point them in the general direction.
But should we be pointing them? But or what responsibility do they have to find that out themselves? What we can review? I mean, there's two sides to the story.
I understand, but it's also like if I look at it as a citizen who happily going about their life and they get in. Mailing.
I think if we started putting things in our noticing. This, and this for residents, well, it's the person applying for it is usually also a resident. So I'm going to tell them, this is how you get your stuff approved. You know, you have to come up with, you know, it's like, I don't think the city staff is here to train everybody in the city regarding conditional use permits or any application. We ask them to look at the code and find something in our code that, you know, but it's, you know, it's, you know, as we get to a point, who are we serving? We're serving residents, but both sides in this case are residents. So how do we, you know, helping one out over helping the other?
I don't think we're trying to help them. I don't think we're trying to help one over the other. Like, I guess it feels that way to you guys, but to me, the way I look at it is like there is perhaps an imbalance of power in the sense that the person that's doing the conditional use permit or whatever has been thinking about this for a long time, potentially having lots of conversations weeks or months and staffs and iterations and with engineers and with all this. And these other people come along and they're just happily going about their life. You get a mailing and they're like, oh, well, I don't know how I think about that. I got to figure out how and what I can do. And if there's no even like guide for them that is provided, I'm not saying like they have to be like, we're not trying to like coach someone up to some outcome, but what we are trying to say is like, here's what this meeting is about. Because and the evidence, I'm going to cite this, is that a lot of the conversations that we get, a lot of people don't even know that we're a non-legislative body, that there's a lot of people who don't understand that they're just talking about their feelings and how, like all that. And so that's what I'm basing it on, is I feel like there's a lot of people that probably, maybe they feel better by addressing this in public comment, but it didn't do much good towards the objective of looking for detrimental effects.
There's a balance to be struck. There's the saying that everybody's charged with the duty of knowing what the law is. And practically, that's not working, but, and you're going to think I'm also saying this because I'm a lawyer, but there's a lot of good lawyers out there. You know, if you really think that this is going to damage the value of your property, there's really good land use lawyers out there. And I'd be happy to refer anybody. I get calls all the time from people that want legal advice from me. And I can't really give them legal advice because I represent the city. And I sometimes will point them out and so forth, but for really not very expensive, they could probably make a phone call and get some advice from people about some of these things. I like the fact that this is engendered discussion. And I want you to know how much of an honor it is for me to work for the city and to work with you, a good, caring, responsible planning commission.
I've got some more. I've got a follow-up question. I don't know how to square the last two slides with each other. So the second to last one talks about factual support, right, for decisions. And yeah. Then the next one talks about decisions supported by substantial evidence. Are those describing the same thing? Are those, does that make sense? Is substantial evidence factual support? Are they?
I think that's an outstanding question. I was thinking somebody who probably would ask that. And the answer is, I don't know. But I think when you, again, I always am sitting there thinking, how am I going to defend this? Please state it on the record. Please tell us what your evidence is. And I think that when it goes up to the court, if you've denied something and you've got, I'm not trying to scare you out of denying something, but I'm going to want to be able to say, Commissioner Bishop, a very smart man, stated on the record that he relied on this evidence. And by the way, it is beyond a scintilla, the evidence he relied on.
He must use that word.
And
the notes next to it.
I think a reasonable mind would accept that evidence as adequate to support a conclusion. And here's why. Here's why that I think that that was evidence adequate to support a conclusion. That's the kind of argument that I would like to make.
Okay. Yeah. Because I was thinking about that, and back to the Davis County versus Clearfield case. And I mean, it seems like if all those people saying, hey, this is a problem, the people that were going to be in this house near, I think, was it school? Mm-hmm. Was it? I mean, that seems like a reasonable mind. It's almost as if they're calling all the people that were objecting unreasonable.
But they didn't bring any support to demonstrate that their fears could come to pass or had merit.
Which is more than the definition of substantial evidence, as I read it.
But it's opinion. So, yeah. I mean, it might be a large number of opinions, but unless they bring something to support.
Yeah. So
we don't know exactly what happened on some of these things, but I suspect that most of the people that stood up said, I think I just want to express my opinion, or I want to tell you that I think that this is a terrible idea. I'm thinking about these kids at the junior high, and they're right across the street from people, these recovering alcoholics, and think of all the possible negative consequences that could happen. The court's not going to accept that.
Right. They could happen. Do you have any documentation to support that they could happen? So go find a facility that's like
this
it.
Did
or
happen, in this instance. Could happen, but
right.
Yeah. Did so happen. It seems like it's more than just what a reasonable mind would accept. Right?
I know what you're saying, though. Right. Like, obviously, yeah. Everybody that showed up is probably a reasonable person.
Yeah.
But their fears don't constitute testimony. Evidence. Evidence is the right word.
Yeah, okay.
From a professional or someone who's an expert in that field.
Yeah. Does the same criteria apply to conditions that we would put on a conditional use? Because I don't think, have we ever denied a conditional use?
I don't know.
I don't.
We haven't denied. We've Maybe denied the motion to approve, and then, yeah. But we've never actually flat out denied.
I think we've always.
Oh, the only one might be the one.
It was recommended.
The one that ended up going to the hearing officer down in the river bottom. The grass. I think that was a conditional use.
But they were, yeah.
But that was, yeah, we may have denied that one, and I believe.
They had other things going on.
Other things as well. Yeah. That's the only one I can recall in 5 years.
The day will come when you will deny one. It just will happen.
And now we'll know exactly the words to say.
Yes.
I'm going to say Davis County versus Clearfield.
That sounds amazing. Thank you so much, Greg. And Greg. Yeah,
thank you.
All right, commissioners, I think we don't even have to adjourn, do we?
No.
All right. Thank you so much, staff.